individuals. When you say 1 in 13 quadrillion, how many zeros are we talking about? That would be a 13 with 15 zeros behind it. Is there a layman's way of explaining the significance of this frequency? Yes. The current population of planet Earth is roughly 7 billion. That number is significantly eclipsed by 13 quadrillion. That tells us there is no one else on Earth or in the last 100 years on Earth who could have that DNA. Only the victim in this case. Only Wilma Fournette. Hammond stole a glance at Dykes. The killer sat unmoving, his eyes downcast and focused on the blank yellow page in front of him. It was the moment. The hammer had come down, and Dykes knew that it was over. Hammond was pleased with the part he had played in the legal play. He was the star witness. But it also pained him to see another man go down for what Hammond did not consider to be much of a crime. He had no doubt that Dykes had done what he had to do, and his wife had gotten what she had coming. He still had to sit for cross-examination, but he knew as well as the defense attorney that he was bulletproof. The science didn't lie. The science was the hammer. He looked out into the rows of the gallery and saw a woman weeping. It was the sister who had urged Kleber to reopen the case after nearly three decades. Hammond was her hero now, her Superman. With an S on his chest for science, he had taken down the villain. It was too bad that her tears didn't touch him. He felt no sympathy for her or her long-held pain. Hammond believed women deserved all the pain they got. Then, two rows behind the weeping woman, Hammond saw Vogel. He had slipped into the court unnoticed. Now Hammond was reminded of the greater villain who was out there, the Shrike, and that everything Hammond and Vogel had worked for was at risk. Chapter 15. Vogel was waiting in the hallway after Hammond finished answering the weak cross-examination from the defense attorney and was finally dismissed as a witness. Vogel was the same age, but not the same demeanor. Hammond was the scientist, the white hat, and Vogel was the hacker, the black hat. Vogel was a guy who only had blue jeans and t-shirts in his closet, and that hadn't changed since they were college roommates. "Way to go, Hammer," Vogel said. "That guy's going down." "Not so loud," Hammond cautioned. "What are you doing here?" "I wanted to see you kick ass in there." "Bullshit." "Okay, come with me." "Where?" "We're not even going to leave the building." Hammond followed Vogel down the hall to the elevator alcove. Vogel pushed the down button and turned to Hammond. "He's here," Vogel said. "Who's here?" Hammond asked. "The guy, the reporter."
"McAvoy?
What do you mean he's here?"
"He's getting arraigned. Hopefully we didn't miss it."
They took the elevator down to the third floor and entered the large and busy arraignment court where Judge Adam Crower was presiding. They took seats on one of the crowded benches of the gallery. Hammond had never seen this part of the system in which he played a part. There were several lawyers standing and sitting while waiting for the names of their clients to be called. There was a wood and glass corral where defendants were brought in eight at a time to confer through narrow windows with their lawyers or with the judge when their case was called. It looked like organized chaos, a place you would not want to be unless you had no choice or were paid to be there.
"What are we doing?" Hammond whispered.
"We're going to see if McAvoy has been arraigned," Vogel whispered back.
"How will we know?"
"Just watch the people they're bringing out. Maybe we'll see him."
"Okay, but what's the point? I don't get why we're looking for this guy."
"Because we might need him."
"How?"
"As you know, Detective Mattson filed his reports on the case in the department's online case archives. I took a look." "You're right. The reporter knew Potrero, the victim.
The detectives interviewed him, and he voluntarily gave his DNA to prove he's not the guy. So? Hammond asked. So? That DNA is somewhere in your lab, and you know what to do.
What are you talking about?
Hammond realized he had said it too loud. People on the benches in front of them turned to look back. What Vogel was suggesting was beyond anything they had even thought of before.
First of all, he whispered, if it's not assigned to me, I can't get near it. Different procedures than Orange County. Second, we both know he isn't the Shrike. I would never frame an innocent man.
Come on. Isn't it just like what you did in Orange County? Vogel whispered back.
What? That was completely different. I kept someone from going to jail for what should not even be a crime. I didn't send him there, and this is a murder we're talking about here.
It was a crime in the eyes of the law.
Have you ever heard the saying that it's better that 100 guilty men escape than 1 innocent suffer? Benjamin fucking Franklin.
Whatever. All I'm saying is, we could use this guy to buy us time. Time to find the Shrike.
And then do what? Say, never mind, I cook the DNA? That might work for you, but not me. We need to shut it all down, everything, now.
Not yet. We need it open in order to find the guy. The dread that had been growing in Hammond's chest was in full bloom now. He knew his hatred and greed had led him to this. It was a nightmare he saw no way out of. Hey, Vogel whispered, I think that's him.
Vogel surreptitiously pointed his chin at the corral at the front of the courtroom. A fresh line of arrestees had been let in by the courtroom deputies. Hammond thought that the third man looked like the mugshot he had seen the night before. It looked like the reporter, Jack McAvoy. He looked weary and worn down from his night in jail.
Jack. Chapter 16. The courtroom was the crowded port of entry to the criminal justice system, a place where those swept up in the maw of the legal machinery stood before a judge for the first time for a reading of the charges against them. Then their initial court date would be scheduled, the first step in their long and twisting pathway through the morass that would leave them at least bowed and bloodied, if not convicted and incarcerated. I saw Bill Marchand rise from a seat in the row running along the front rail of the courtroom and start making his way toward me. It had been a night without sleep, and every muscle in my body seemed to hurt from the hours I had spent clenched like a fist and fearful in the communal holding tank. I had been in jail before and knew that danger could come from any quarter. It was a place where men felt betrayed by their lives and the world, and that made them desperate and dangerous, ready to attack anybody and anything that appeared vulnerable. When Marchand got to the slot through which we would be able to talk, I opened with the 5 most urgent words in the world to me. Get me out of here. The lawyer nodded. That's the plan, he said. I already talked to the prosecutor and explained to her the hornet's nest her detectives have kicked over. And she's going to null pros this one. We'll get you out of here in a couple hours tops.
The DA's just going to drop the charge? I asked.
Actually, it's the city attorney because it's a misdemeanor charge, but they've got nothing to support it. You were doing your job, with full First Amendment protections. Myron's here and ready to go to war. I told the prosecutor, you arraign this reporter on that charge, and that man over there will hold a press conference outside the courthouse within the hour. And it won't be the kind of press her office wants.
Where's Myron now?
I scanned the crowded rows of the gallery. I didn't see Myron, but motion caught my eye, and I thought I saw someone duck behind another person, as though bending down to pick something up. When the man came back up, he looked at me, and then shifted behind the person sitting in front of him. He was balding and wore glasses. It wasn't Myron.
He's around somewhere, Marchand said. At that moment, I heard my name as Judge Crower called my case. Marchand turned to the bench and identified himself as counsel for the defense. A woman stood up at the crowded prosecution table and identified herself as Deputy City Attorney Jocelyn Rose. Your Honor, we move to drop the charge against the defendant at this time, she said.
You're sure? Crower asked.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well, case dismissed. Mr. McAvoy, you're free to go.
Only I wasn't. I wasn't free to go until after a 2-hour wait to be bussed back to the county jail, where my property was returned and I was processed out. The morning was gone. I had missed both breakfast and lunch at the jail, and I had no transportation home. But when I stepped through the jail exit, I found Myron Levin waiting for me.
Sorry, Myron. How long were you waiting?
It's okay. I have my phone. You all right?
I am now.
You hungry? Or you want to go home?
Both. But I'm starving.
Let's go eat.
Thanks for coming for me, Myron.
To get to the food quicker, we went just over to Chinatown and ordered po' boy sandwiches at Little Jewel. We grabbed a table and waited for them to be made.
So, what are you going to do? I asked.
About what?
Myron asked.
The LAPD's flagrant violation of the First Amendment. Matson can't get away with this shit. You should hold a press conference anyway. I bet the Times will be all over this.
The New York Times, I'm talking about.
It's not that simple.
It's very simple. I was on a story, Matson didn't like it, so he falsely arrests me. It's not only First Amendment, it's the Fourth as well. They had no probable cause to detain me. I was doing my job.
I know all of that, but the charges were dropped and you're back on the story. No harm, no foul.
What? I spent a night in jail, where I was backed into a corner with my eyes open all night.
But nothing happened. You're okay.
No, I'm not okay, Myron. You try it sometime.
Look, I'm sorry for what happened, but I think we should roll with it, not inflame things any further, and get back on the story.
Speaking of which, I got a text from Emily. She says she got some good stuff from UC Irvine. I looked across the table at Myron for a long moment, trying to read him.
Don't deflect the conversation, I said. What is it really? The donors?
No, Jack. I told you before, the donors have nothing to do with this, Myron said. I would no sooner let donors dictate what we do and what we cover than I would let big tobacco or the auto industry dictate to us.
Then why are we sitting on our hands on this? That guy Matson needs to be raked over the coals.
Okay, if you want to know the truth, I think if we make a stink about this, it could come back on us.
Why would that happen?
Because of you.
And me.
You are a person of interest in this case until we know otherwise, and I'm the editor who didn't yank you off it when I should have. If we go to war, that's all going to come out, and it's not going to look that great, Jack.
I leaned back and shook my head in impotent protest. I knew he was right. Maybe Matson had known he could do what he did because we were compromised.
Shit, I said.
Myron's name was called because he had paid for lunch. He got up and got our sandwiches. When he returned, I was too hungry to keep talking about the issue. I had to eat. I mowed through half of my po' boy before saying another word. By then, without the edge of hunger in my anger, my desire for a constitutional battle with the LAPD had waned.
It's just that I feel like this is where we've come to, I said. Fake news, enemy of the people, the president canceling subscriptions to the Washington Post and New York Times. The LAPD thinks nothing of just throwing a reporter in jail. At what point do we take a stand?
Well, this would not be the time, Myron said. If we're going to take that stand, then we have to do it when we are 100% clean, so there are no comebacks from the police or the politicians who love seeing journalists thrown in jail.
I shook my head and dropped the argument.
I couldn't win, and the truth was, I wanted to get back to the story more than I wanted to take on the LAPD.
All right, fuck it, I said. What did Emily say she has?
She didn't, Myron said. She just said she got good stuff and was heading back up to the office. I figure that after we finish here, we'll go back to the valley and meet with her.
Can you drop me in my apartment first? My car's there, and I want to take a shower before I do anything else.
You got it.
My phone, wallet, and keys had been confiscated during the booking process. When they had been returned upon my departure, I stuffed them back into my pockets in a hurry because I wanted to get out of that place as soon as I could. It became clear that I should have looked more carefully at the keychain when Myron dropped me off in front of my building on Woodman. The key to the front gate was on the ring, as well as the key to the Jeep, a storage locker in the garage, and a bike lock. But the key to my apartment was missing. It was only after I rousted the live-in property manager from a post-lunch nap and borrowed the management copy of the key that I got into the apartment. Once in, I found a copy of a search warrant receipt on the kitchen counter. While I was in a jail cell the night before, Mattson and Sakai were searching my apartment. They had most likely used my trumped-up obstruction case as part of the probable cause for the search. I realized that was probably their goal all along. They knew the case would get kicked, but they used it with a judge to get into my home. My anger quickly returned, and again I took their action as a direct assault on my rights. I pulled my phone and called the LAPD's Robbery Homicide Division and asked for Mattson. I was transferred.
Detective Mattson, how can I help you?
Mattson, you better hope I don't solve this before you, because I will make you look like the piece of shit you are.
McAvoy? I heard they turned you loose. Why are you so mad?
Because I know what you did. You booked me so you could search my place, because you are so far up your ass on this case you wanted to see what I had.
Looking at the search warrant receipt, I saw that they did not list a single item being taken.
I want my key back, I said, and whatever you took from here.
We didn't take anything, Mattson said,
and I have your key right here. You are welcome to come by any time and pick it up.
I suddenly froze. I wasn't sure where my laptop was. Had Mattson taken it? I quickly reviewed the evening before and realized I had left my backpack in the Jeep when I decided to go up to the front curb to check my mailbox. I'd been intercepted there by Mattson and Sakai. I grabbed the search warrant receipt and quickly checked to see if the search was authorized for my home and vehicle. My laptop was fingerprint and password protected, but I assumed it would be easy for Mattson to go to the cyber unit and have someone hack their way in.
If Mattson got into my laptop, he would have everything I had and know everything I knew about the investigation. The search warrant was only for the apartment. I would find out in the next 30 seconds if there was a second warrant waiting in my car.
McAvoy, you there?
I didn't bother responding. I disconnected the call and headed for the door. I went down the concrete steps to the garage and quickly crossed to my Jeep. My backpack was on the passenger seat where I remembered putting it the day before. I returned to my apartment with the backpack and dumped its contents on the kitchen counter. The laptop was there, and it appeared that Mattson had not gotten to it or the case notes. The rest of the contents of the backpack seemed to have been untouched as well. The relief that came from not having my work and my emails rifled through by the police came with a wave of exhaustion. No doubt due to my sleepless night in jail. I decided to stretch out on the couch and catch a half-hour nap before going into the office to meet with Myron and Emily. I set a timer and was asleep within minutes, my last waking thought about the men I'd been bused to the courthouse with that morning, all of them most likely back in their cells now, in a place where just closing your eyes made you vulnerable.
Chapter 17. I was disoriented when I woke. I had been stirred from a deep sleep by the sound of a leaf blower outside.
I checked my phone for the time, but it was dead, having spent the night in a jail property room rather than on a charger. I had no doubt slept through my allotted 30 minutes. I didn't wear a watch since I usually carried the time on my phone. I got up and stumbled into the kitchen, where I saw it was 4:17 on the oven. I had been out more than 2 hours. I had to plug my phone in and wait for it to get enough charge for the screen to activate. I then texted Myron and Emily on a group text and explained my delay. I asked if it was too late to meet, and the response was immediate. Come to the office. 25 minutes later, we met. The text Emily had sent Myron earlier was correct. She had gotten good stuff on William Orton down at UC Irvine. We met in the Fair Warning conference room, and she laid out what she had found. First of all, none of this is on the record, she said. If we want to use it, we need to find independent verification, which I think will exist at the Anaheim Police Department if we can find a source there.
How good is your source at the school? Myron asked.
She's an assistant dean now, Emily said. But 4 years ago, when this all went down, she was the assistant to the coordinator of the Title IX unit. Do you know what Title IX is, Jack?
Yes, I said. That's the sexual violence and harassment protocol for all schools that get federal money.
Correct, Emily said. So my source told me off the record and on deep background that William Orton was suspected of being a serial abuser of his students, but they never got the goods on him. Victims got intimidated, witnesses recanted. They never got a solid case against him until Jane Doe came along.
Jane Doe? I asked.
She was a student, a biology major, who took classes from Orton and claimed he had roofied her and then raped her after a chance encounter at a bar in Anaheim. She came to naked in a motel room, and the last thing she remembered was the drink with him.
What a creep, Myron said.
You mean, what a criminal, Emily said.
That too, Myron said. What happened? Jane Doe change her mind?
No, not at all, Emily said. She was solid and smart. She called the police that night, and they got a rape kit and took blood. Orton used a condom during the assault, but they got saliva off her nipples. They were building a solid case against this guy. The tox on Jane came back with flunitrazepam, better known as Rohypnol, the date rape drug. They had a solid witness in the victim, and they were good to go with the case. They were just waiting on the DNA.
What happened? I asked.
The DNA typing was done by the Orange County Sheriff's Lab, Emily said. The saliva came back as no match to Orton.
You're kidding, Myron said.
I wish, Emily said. It killed the case. It cast doubt on her story because she had said under questioning that she had not been with another man for 6 days. An investigator with the district attorney's office down there then dug up a number of prior sex partners Jane Doe had been involved with. It all added up to the DA passing. They wouldn't touch it without the direct DNA link. I thought about what Jason Huang had said about the DRD4 gene. The Orange County DA had dismissed Jane Doe as promiscuous and therefore not believable enough to support the case at trial.
You said it was a chance encounter, I said. Was there any more on that? How did they know it was a chance encounter?
I didn't ask that, Emily said. They just said it was random, you know. They ran into each other in a bar.
Did the saliva match anybody else? I asked.
Unknown donor, Emily said. There was a rumor going around at the time that Orton, being a DNA researcher, had somehow altered his own DNA to prevent the match.
Sounds like science fiction, Myron said.
It does, said Emily. According to my source, they ran the test at the sheriff's lab a second time, and it came back as a negative match.
What about tampering? Myron asked.
It was suggested, but the sheriff's department stood by the lab. Emily said. I think any indication that there was an evidence integrity problem would endanger every conviction that relied on that lab for evidence analysis, and they weren't going to go down that road.
And Orton walked away, I said.
To a degree,
Emily said. There was no criminal case, but there was enough smoke because of Jane Doe's unwavering story, even in the face of the DNA, for the school to go after Orton under the employee conduct policies. Their mandate wasn't criminal. They needed to protect other students at the school, so they quietly negotiated his exit. He kept his pension, and a cloak of silence was dropped over the whole thing.
And what happened to Jane Doe? I asked.
That I don't know, Emily said. I asked my source, whom she dealt with at Anaheim PD, and she could only remember that the detective who handled it had a perfect name for a detective, Dig.
First or last? I asked.
She said first, Emily said. She described him as Latino, so I'm assuming the first name is Digoberto, or a variation of that. It shouldn't be too hard to figure out.
I nodded.
So, Myron said, Orton gets shown the door at UC Irvine and just sets up shop in a private lab down the road. He got off easy.
He did, Emily said. But, like my source told me, their big concern was getting him out of the school.
What about that rumor about changing his DNA? I asked. Is that even possible?
I did a little bit of research while waiting for you to show up, Emily said. Gene editing technologies are advancing every day, but they are not at the point, and certainly not 4 years ago when this happened, where you can change your entire code. What happened with the Jane Doe case is a mystery. According to my source, Jane Doe had a lawyer ready to sue Orton and the school. His office conducted its own testing on the sample and got the same result. No lawsuit was ever filed.
All three of us were silent for a moment before Myron spoke.
So what's next? He asked.
It was my story, and I wanted to be protective of it, but I had to acknowledge that Emily Atwater had moved it along in a big way.
Well, one thing we have to remember is that William Orton is a shady figure, but what Jack is pursuing does not touch him. Yet, Emily said.
It bears further reporting, but let's look at where we are. The four victims we know about were GT-23 participants. It is possible, but not yet proved, that their DNA could have been sold to Orton's lab for his research purposes. Now add in that Orton appears to be a sexual predator, and it all gets more interesting. But we have nothing concrete that connects one with the other.
Exactly, Myron said. I'm wondering how far we go with this without a stronger connection.
Myron looked at me, which I took as a good sign. It was still my story, and he wanted to hear from me.
I think it's part of throwing out the net, I said. We have to see what comes up. I think the thing to do is try to get inside Orange Nano and talk to Orton. Maybe get a feel for him from a direct contact. I'm not sure how to do that, though. I don't think we should call up and say, we're looking into the murders of four women. We need another way in.
I was thinking about that, Emily said. Again, waiting for Jack today, I was looking around for anything I could find on Orton, and I found one listing for him in an annual report for the Rexford Corporation. He's a member of the board.
What's Rexford do? I asked.
Primarily, it's hair products for men, Emily said, with an emphasis on alopecia, hair loss. It is on the rise in both genders and within 5 years is expected to be a $4 billion industry.
Orton's trying to cure it, I said.
My guess too, Emily said.
If he can discover or create the genetic therapy that cures it or even slows it down, then just think what that would be worth. He's on the Rexford board because the company is funding his research, and that could be our way in.
We say we're looking into hair loss? I asked.
We follow the money, Emily said.
Billions are being spent each year, but there's no cure. Not now.
We go in with the consumer angle. How many of these treatments are worthless, and where are we on the genetic cure? We play to Orton's ego. Say, we heard that if anybody's going to make the breakthrough, it's you.
It was a good plan, only marred by my wish that I had thought of it first. I said nothing. And Myron looked at me.
What do you think, Jack? He asked.
Well,
This alopecia research is new to me, I said. Jason Huang told me that Orton was studying addiction and risky behaviors. Going bald is not connected with either, as far as I know.
That's how these researchers work, Emily said. They get a ride on a big pharma ticket to do research in one arena, and it funds their other research, the stuff that really holds their interest. Rexford is paying for the research they want, but funding the research Orton wants.
I nodded. Then I think it's a good idea, I said. That's our way in. Maybe we go through Rexford first, get their corporate PR people to set it up, make it harder for Orton to say no, especially if he's got something hinky going on down there.
That's a good idea, Emily said. I'll call first thing in the morning, I said. Try to get it set.
Tell them there will be two of you on the interview, Myron said.
What do you mean? I asked.
I want you both to go down there, Myron said.
I think I can handle it, I said.
I'm sure you can, Myron said. But for security reasons, I want you both to go. Emily, take the Canon, and you can take photos.
I'm not a photographer, Emily protested.
Just take the camera, Myron said.
What about Anaheim PD? Emily asked. You want us to tag team that too?
I was going to go down there tomorrow, I said. I'll find Detective Dig.
Emily said nothing. I was expecting a protest, with her claiming it was her lead, but she didn't make one.
Okay, fine. You go, Jack, Myron said. But listen, I don't want this to be a competition. Work together. I'm devoting half our staff to this. We can't waste time. Find out if there is something there, and if not, get out and move on to the next story.
Got it, Emily said.
Okay, I said.
The meeting broke up after that, and we returned to our respective workstations. The first thing I did was call the Anaheim Police Department and try to get a line on Dig. This turned out to be easy. I asked for the detective bureau and asked the woman who answered, "Can I speak to Dig?" "I'm sorry, Detective Ruiz is gone for the day. Can I take a message?"
"No, that's okay. Will he be working tomorrow?"
"He is, but he's signed out to court all day. Do you want to leave a message?"
"No, I guess I'll see him at the courthouse. That's the rape case?"
This was an educated guess based on Ruiz working the Jane Doe Orton case.
"Yes, Isaiah Gamble. Who can I tell him called?"
"That's okay. I'll see him there tomorrow. Thank you."
After disconnecting, I pulled up the Orange County District Attorney's Office website and plugged the name Isaiah Gamble into the search window. This led me to an extract on the case, abduction and forcible rape, and the courtroom it was assigned to in the courthouse in Santa Ana. I'd be good to go in the morning. I was writing the information down in a notebook when I was interrupted by a text from Rachel Walling. "You want to get a drink tonight?" It came out of the blue. I drop in on her unannounced for the first time in more than a year, and the next day she wants to have a drink. I didn't wait long to reply.
"Sure. Where? What time?"
I waited, but there was no immediate reply. I started packing up for the day, shoving into my backpack everything I might need in Orange County the next day. I was about to get up and leave when I got the return message from Rachel. "I'm in the valley. I could meet now or later. How about that place you met Christina? I want to see it." I stared at my phone's screen. I knew that she meant Mistral. That seemed a bit weird, but maybe there was going to be more to the meeting than a drink. Maybe Rachel had changed her mind about my proposal to her. I texted back with the name and address and told her I was on my way. I went by Emily Atwater's cubicle on my way out. She looked up from her screen. "I located Dig," I said. "His last name is Ruiz. He's going to be in court tomorrow on another case."
"That's perfect," Emily said.
"You should be able to get to him there."
"Yeah, that's what I thought. And also, I wanted to say sorry if it seems like I'm being a dick."
"No, you aren't. It was your story. I get it."
I nodded.
"Thanks for understanding," I said.
"So if you want to go down with me to find Ruiz, that would be fine. It was your lead."
"No, I'm fine to stay up here, actually," she said. "I was thinking that while you do that,
I'll see what I can come up with through the feds. I'll start with the FDA.
They're not doing anything on this, I said. They're still in the thinking about it enforcement stage.
Yes, but we need to get that on the record and ask why it is and when it's going to change. The government is behind the curve, and that's a big part of the story.
Right. So I'll do that, and you go down to Orange County. I'll try to set something up with Orton through Rexford PR. I'll let you know. She smiled. Somehow it made me think I was still being a dick about things.
So, we're good? I asked.
Sure, she said. Let's see what things are tomorrow.
I nodded, and she spoke as I turned to leave. I would never apologize for being protective about my story, Jack. I looked back at her.
You saw something and went after it, she said. You have every right to keep it.
Okay, I said.
See you tomorrow, she said.
Chapter 18. Rachel was already at the bar at Mistral when I got there, her martini glass half full. She didn't see me enter, and so I stood back and looked at her for a few moments. She had her eyes down on the bar, reading a document. She reached for the stem of the martini glass without looking, and then took a small sip. My interactions with her had spanned nearly 25 years, and had been hot and cold, intense and distant, intimate and strictly professional, and ultimately heartbreaking. From the beginning, she had left a hole in my heart that could never quite heal. I could go years without seeing her, but I could never stop thinking about her. Thinking about where she was, what she was doing, who she was with. I knew the moment I decided to visit her the day before that I was buying myself another round of hope and hurt. But some people are fated this way, fated to play the same music over and over like a scratched record. The moment was ruined when the bartender saw me standing by the door and called out her version of my name.
Jacques, what are you doing? She said. Come in, come in.
Elle, whose last name I did not know, spoke with a French accent. She knew me as a regular, though she put a French twist on my name. Still, it was close enough that it caused Rachel to look up and see me, and my moment of reverie and hope ended. I walked to the bar and sat next to Rachel.
Hey, been here long? I asked.
No, just ahead of you, Rachel said. Elle came down the bar to take my order.
The usual, Jacques? She asked.
Sure, I said. Elle went back down the bar to where the bottle of Kettle One was and started preparing my drink.
The usual, Jacques?
Rachel whispered mockingly. You know that accent is fake, right?
She's an actress, I said. The place is French.
Only in L.A. Or maybe Paris.
So what brings you over the hill to the valley?
Trying to hook up a new client, and today we had the dog and pony show.
Background searching?
Our meat and potatoes.
So you go in there, flash the former FBI credentials, and tell them what you can do, and they give you their business?
That's a little simplistic, but yeah, that's how it works.
Elle brought my martini over and put it down on a cocktail napkin.
Voila, she said.
Merci, I said.
Elle moved back down the bar, smart enough to give us space.
And this is your hang? Rachel said. The bartender with the phony French accent?
I only live a couple blocks away, I said. I can walk home if I get into trouble.
Or you get lucky. Gotta get them home before they change their minds, right?
That's a low blow, and I wish I hadn't even told you that yesterday. That is the one and only time that ever happened to me here.
I'm sure.
It's true, but it's beginning to sound like you're jealous.
That'll be the day.
We broke off the conversation there for a few moments, and I had the feeling we were both reviewing memories of our checkered history. It always seemed to be me who blew it. Once during the poet investigation, when my own insecurities caused me to doubt her in a relationship-stunting way, and the last time, when I put my work ahead of our relationship and put her into an intolerable position. Now, we were left to meet at a bar and trade coy remarks. What could have been was killing me.
I have to say, I am jealous about one thing,
Rachel said.
That I live in the valley now?
I said.
I still couldn't get away from the coy remark. Jesus.
No, that you're on a case, she said. A real case.
What are you talking about? I asked. You have your own business.
Which is 90% sitting at a computer and doing background searches. I haven't worked a real... I'm not using my skills, Jack. And if you don't use them, you lose them. You coming in yesterday just reminded me of what I don't do anymore.
I'm sorry. I know it's all on me. Your badge. Everything. I fucked everything up for a story. I was so blind, and I'm so sorry.
Jack, I didn't come because I need your apology. The past is the past.
Then what, Rachel?
I don't know. I just...
She didn't finish. But I knew this was going to be a quick drink and goodbye. I held two fingers up to Elle at the other end of the bar. Two more.
Did you do anything with what we talked about yesterday?
Rachel asked. I did, I said. I got some really good stuff and would have continued today, but then I ended up staying all night in jail.
What? Why?
Because the LAPD guy on the case is scared. Scared I'm ahead of him on this. So he grabbed me up on a trumped-up obstruction thing last night, and I spent all night in Metro, and then half the day in court and riding jail buses back and forth. I finished my martini just as Elle delivered a new one.
Je vous en prie, she said.
Merci, I said.
Gracias, Rachel said.
Elle went away.
Hey, we forgot, I said. I held my fresh drink up.
To the single bullet theory? I asked.
Maybe that was going too far, but Rachel did not balk. She held her glass up and nodded. It was a reference to something she had told me years before, that she believed everybody had somebody out there in the world who could pierce their heart like a bullet. Not everybody had the fortune of meeting that person, and not everybody could hold on to that person if they did meet. To me, there had never been any doubt. Rachel was the one. Her name was on the bullet that pierced me. We clinked glasses. But then, Rachel moved on before any more could be said on that subject.
Were you charged?
She asked. The deputy city attorney kicked the case as soon as she saw it, I said. It's just a new form of harassment in the era where reporters are viewed by some as lower than scum. These cops think they can get away with everything.
You really think you're out in front of them on this case?
I do. Have you changed your mind about...
What have you gotten?
I spent the next 20 minutes telling her about Jason Hwang, William Orton, and how my partner on the story, Emily Atwater, had made further strides with a source at UC Irvine. Rachel asked several questions and offered bits of advice here and there. It was clear that she felt I was onto something that was right in her 10 ring. She had once hunted serial killers with the FBI. Now, she was doing background searches on job candidates. We drank another round of martinis, and when the talking ended, there was a decision to be made.
You just leave your car here?
Rachel asked. The valets know me here, I said. If I'm walking home because I've had one too many, they'll give me back my keys. Then I just walk back up in the morning and get my car.
Well, I shouldn't drive either.
You can walk with me to my place. We can come back for your car when you're ready to drive. There it was, a half-assed invitation. She gave it a half-smile in return.
And what if that is not until the morning?
She asked. Three martinis? I think it's going to take at least that long, I said. I paid the tab with a Platinum American Express card. Rachel sighed.
You still getting royalties, Jack?
Some. Less every year, but the books are still in print.
I heard that every time they catch a new serial, he has a copy of The Poet somewhere in his possessions.
It's also a popular book in every prison I've ever been in. Good to know. Maybe I should have had a book signing in Metro last night. She laughed loudly. And I knew she'd overdone it with the martinis. She was usually too much in control to laugh out loud like that. Let's go before we both pass out,
I said. We slid off our stools and headed for the door. The alcohol continued to loosen her tongue as we walked the two blocks. I just want you to know that the maid at my place has been on vacation for about a year, I said. She laughed again.
I would expect nothing less, she said. I remember some of your places. Heavy on The Bachelor.
Yeah, well, I guess some things never change, I said.
I want in, she said.
I took a few unsteady steps without responding. I wondered if she was talking about our relationship or my story. She made it clear without my asking.
I'm making tons of money, but I'm not doing anything, she said. I had a skill, Jack. Now.
That's why I came to see you yesterday, I said. I thought you would be.
You know what I did today? I presented to a company that makes plastic furniture. They want to make sure they don't hire any illegals. So they come to me, and guess what? I'll take their money if they want to give it to me.
Well, that's what the business is about. You knew that when,
Jack, I want to do something. I want to help. I can help you with your story.
Yeah. I thought maybe you'd want to profile this guy, whoever's doing this. Also the victims.
No, I want more than that. I want to be out there on this. Like with the scarecrow.
I nodded. We had worked hand in hand on that.
Well, this is a little different.
You were an agent back then, and I already have a partner on, but I can really help you on this. I still have connections in the federal government. I can get things. Find out things you can't.
What things?
I don't know yet. I would have to see, but I still know people in all the agencies because I worked with them.
I nodded. We had gotten to my building. I couldn't tell how much of what she was saying was the alcohol talking, but she seemed to be talking from the heart. I fumbled with the keys to open the gate.
Let's go in and sit down, I said. We'll talk more about it.
I don't want to talk anymore tonight, Jack, she said.
Chapter 19. I had never been to the courthouse in Santa Ana, nor had I ever driven from the San Fernando Valley down to Orange County on a weekday morning. I left at 7 to make sure I got there before 9. That was after I walked up the street twice to Mistral to retrieve my Jeep and then Rachel's BMW. I parked hers in front of the building, in the same spot Mattson and Sakai had used to arrest me. I then returned her key to the table next to the bed where she slept. I wrote a note asking her to call me when she woke up and left it with 2 Advils on the bed table. Rachel might find waking to an empty apartment upsetting, but I wanted to get to Detective Digoberto Ruiz before the trial started. Best laid plans. After tie-ups on both the 101 and 5 freeways, I rolled into the parking garage at the Criminal Courts building in Santa Ana at 9:20. Proceedings in the trial of Isaiah Gamble were already underway. I slipped into the back row of the gallery and watched. I was in luck. It took me only a few minutes to realize that Detective Ruiz was the man on the witness stand giving testimony. The gallery of the courtroom was empty, except for me and a woman in the front row on the prosecution side of the room. The case apparently had drawn no attention from the local populace or media. The prosecutor was a woman who stood at a lectern between the prosecution and defense tables. The jury was to her left, 12 jurors and 2 alternates, still alert and paying attention in the first hour of the day. The defendant, Isaiah Gamble, sat at a table next to another woman. I knew that it was part of the sexual predator playbook to go to trial with a female lawyer. It forces the jury to ask, if this man really did what they say he did, would a woman represent him? Ruiz looked close to retirement. He had a gray fringe of hair circling a bald dome and permanently sad eyes. He had seen too much on his job. He was recounting just one episode of many. I met with the victim at the hospital, he said. She was being treated for her injuries, and evidence was being collected.
And was she able to provide you with other evidence or information? The prosecutor asked.
Yes, she had memorized a license plate that was in the trunk of the car with her.
It wasn't on the car?
No, it had been removed.
Why was it removed?
Probably to help the suspect avoid being identified in case someone saw the abduction.
The defense attorney objected to the detective's answer, saying it was conjecture. The judge ruled that Ruiz had more than enough experience in rape cases to form the opinion he had voiced and allowed the answer to stand. It also emboldened the prosecutor to take the question further.
You've seen this before in cases? She asked. The removal of the license plate?
Yes, Ruiz said.
As an experienced detective, what does that indicate to you?
Premeditation, that he had a plan and went out hunting.
Hunting?
Looking for a victim, for prey.
So going back to the victim being in the trunk, wasn't it too dark in the trunk to see the plate?
It was dark, but every time the kidnapper hit the brakes, the taillights lit up part of the trunk and she could see. She memorized the plate that way.
And what did you do with that information?
I ran the plate on the computer and got the registered owner's name.
Who was it registered to?
Isaiah Gamble.
The defendant?
Yes.
What did you do next, Detective Ruiz?
I pulled Gamble's photo from his driver's license, put it in a six-pack, and showed it to the victim.
Please tell the jury what a six-pack is.
It's a photo lineup. I put together six photos, including the shot of Isaiah Gamble and five other men of the same race and similar age, build, hair, and complexion. I then showed it to the victim and asked if any of the men in the photos was the man who abducted and raped her.
And did she identify any of the men in the photo lineup?
Without hesitation, she identified the photo of Isaiah Gamble as being that of the man who had abducted, raped, and beaten her.
Did you have her sign her name under the photo of the man she identified?
Yes, I did.
And did you bring that six-pack with you to court today?
I did.
The prosecutor went through the steps of introducing the six-pack as a state's exhibit, and the judge accepted it. 20 minutes later, Ruiz had completed his direct testimony, and the judge took the morning break before the defense's cross-examination would start. He told the jurors and all parties to be back in 15 minutes. I watched Ruiz intently to see if he would leave the courtroom for a restroom or coffee break, but at first, he stayed seated in the witness box and small-talked with the courtroom clerk. But then the clerk took a phone call and turned her attention away from the detective. After another minute, Ruiz stood up and told the prosecutor he was going to the restroom and would be right back. I watched Ruiz walk out the door and then followed him. I gave him a 1 minute lead time in the restroom before I entered. He was at the sink washing his hands. I went to a sink two down and started doing the same. We saw each other in the mirror over the sink between us and both nodded.
That must feel good, I said.
What's that? Ruiz asked.
Putting sexual predators away for a long time.
Ruiz looked at me strangely.
I was in the courtroom, I said. I saw you testify.
Oh, Ruiz said.
You're not on the jury, are you? I can't have any contact with...
No, I'm not. I'm a reporter, actually, down from L.A.
For this case?
No, not this one. Another case you handled. My name's Jack McAvoy. I threw the paper towel I was drying my hands with into the trash can and offered my hand. Ruiz took it tentatively. I didn't know if that was because of what I had said or the general awkwardness that comes from holding out a hand in a restroom.
What other case? Ruiz asked.
I guess it's the one who got away, I said. William Orton. I watched his face for a reaction and thought I caught a glimpse of anger flare before his face turned to stone.
How do you know about that case? He asked.
Sources, I said. I know what he did at UCI. You didn't put him in jail, but at least you got him away from the students there.
Look, I can't talk to you about that case. I need to get back to court now.
Can't or won't? Ruiz opened the door and looked back at me.
You're doing a story about Orton? He asked.
Yes, I said, whether you talk to me or not. I'd rather it be after we've talked and you can explain why he was never charged. What do you think you know about him or that case? I know he may still be a predator. That enough? I have to go back to court. If you're still here after I'm finished, then maybe we can talk. He was gone, and the door slowly closed. After I returned to the courtroom, I watched the defense lawyer cross-examine Ruiz, but she scored no points that I could tally, and made one large misstep in asking a question that allowed Ruiz to state that DNA collected at the hospital after the abduction and rape was matched to her client. This, of course, would come out anyway, or may have already come out through an earlier prosecution witness, but it's never a good thing for the defense to reference the state's key piece of evidence against your client. After 20 minutes of questions gained little traction for her client's cause, she gave up, and the detective was dismissed as a witness. I left the courtroom and sat on a bench in the hallway. If Ruiz was going to talk to me, he would come out. But when he did, it was to collect the next witness, who was waiting in the hall on the next bench down. I heard Ruiz call her Dr. Sloan and tell her she was up. He walked her to the courtroom, and when he opened the door for her, he looked back at me and nodded. I took it to mean he would be back for me. Another 10 minutes passed, and Ruiz finally came out of the courtroom again and sat on the bench next to me. "I should be in there," he said. "The prosecutor doesn't know the case like I do." "That doctor, is she the DNA expert?" I asked. "No, she runs the rape treatment center at the hospital. She collected the evidence. The DNA expert comes next." "How long will the trial last?" "We'll finish tomorrow morning. Then it will be whatever the defense puts on, which doesn't look like much." "If it was such a lost cause, why didn't he plead, get a deal?" "Because a guy like that, we don't give him a deal." "Why are you here?" "I'm working on a story, and it's taken me to Orton. We found out about the UCI case, and I wondered why it never went anywhere." "Short answer, the DNA didn't match. We had the victim's ID, witness corroboration of checkable facts, but the DNA knocked our legs out. The DA passed." "How is Orton related to what you're working on?" I could see what Ruiz was doing. He was trading. He'd give up information to get information. But so far, he hadn't told me anything I didn't already know. "I'm looking at the murder of a woman," I said. "No direct link in the case to Orton, but I think her DNA went through his lab." "At UCI?" Ruiz asked. "No, this is after he left, his current lab, Orange Nano." "I don't get the connection." "My victim was killed by a sexual predator. From what I've found out about Orton, he's one too." "I can't make that statement. We never charged him with a crime." "But you wanted to. It was the DA who wouldn't go forward." "With good reason. DNA works both ways. It convicts and it clears." I pulled out my notebook to write down that line. It freaked Ruiz out. "You can't use anything from me. I don't want to be sued by him. There was no case. The DNA cleared him." "But you had the victim's story." "Doesn't matter. The DNA threw a wrench into things. Made the case untenable. We didn't proceed. End of story." Do you work for the Times up there?"
"I work for a website that partners with the Times on occasion."
"How surprised were you when the DNA came back and it wasn't a match to William Orton?"
"Off the record? Very. On the record? No comment."
I put my notebook down on the bench so he would not perceive it as a threat. "Any theories on the DNA and where it came from?" I asked.
"Nope," Ruiz said. "I just know it killed the case. It didn't matter how credible our victim seemed. DNA from another man on her body killed the case."
"What about the possibility of tampering?"
"I don't see where. I took the sample from Orton with a court order. I delivered it to the lab. You accusing me of something?"
"Not at all, just asking. There's also the second sample Orton's was compared to. Was there any kind of internal investigation of that?"
"Not beyond doing the test over and getting the same results. You're talking about a very sensitive subject."
You know what the criminal defense lawyers in this courthouse would do with something like that? We'd get buried with appeals of every conviction that ever came out of that lab.
I nodded. It was a case of looking into the matter, but not looking too hard.
How did the victim take it when you told her? I asked.
She was more surprised than me, I'll tell you that, Ruiz said. She insisted then, and still does, that there was no other man, just Orton.
Did you ever talk to him, interview him, I mean? Maybe when you took his swab?
Not really. We started to get into it, but then he lawyered up and that was it. You know, you were right about this one, what you said.
What did I say?
About him being the one who got away. The motherfucker's a rapist, I know it. And the DNA doesn't change that. That's off the record, too.
Ruiz stood up.
I need to go back in, he said.
Two more quick questions, I said. He gestured for me to go ahead. I stood up. Jane Doe's lawyer, who was that?
Hervé Gaspar. I recommended him to her.
What is Jane Doe's real name?
You should be able to get that from your source at the school.
Okay, then what about the lab report on the DNA? Where can I get that?
You can't. All that got destroyed when the case wasn't filed. The lab report, the records. His arrest was expunged after his lawyer got a court order.
Shit. You're telling me. Ruiz turned toward the courtroom door and took a few steps, but then stopped and came back to me.
Do you have a card or something? In case.
Sure. I opened a zipper on my backpack, dug out a business card, and handed it to him.
Call any time, I said, and good luck with this one.
Thanks, he said, but with this one, we don't need luck. He's going down. I watched him go back into the courtroom to take care of business. Chapter 20. When I turned my phone on after leaving the courthouse, I had a message from Randall Sachs, head of public relations for the Rexford Corporation. With the two-hour time difference in Indianapolis working in my favor, I had called him on my drive down. It was early my time, but he was well into his day, and I told him I needed to get into Orange Nano and interview William Orton. I made it clear that if he turned down my request, I would wonder what they were hiding at Rexford, a publicly traded company, when I could not speak to a board member and top researcher. I told him that I would be in the vicinity of Orange Nano later in the day and would love to make the visit then. The message was that my photographer and I had a 2 o'clock interview with Orton that came with a hard stop at 3. I immediately called Sachs back to confirm, and he gave me the lowdown on who I should ask for on arrival and reminded me that the interview would last no more than an hour. He implied that Orton was against the interview, but he, Sachs, had been able to make him see the light.
We are a transparent company, Sachs assured me.
I thanked him, disconnected, and immediately called Emily Atwater.
How fast can you get down here? I asked.
We have a 2 o'clock with Orton.
I'll leave right now, and should make it in time for us to work out a script, she said.
Okay, good. Don't forget the camera. You're the photographer, and I'm the interviewer.
Don't be a dick. I know what I'm supposed to be.
Sorry. You get anything out of the feds?
The FTC was good. I'll tell you about it when I'm down there.
Now who's being a dick?
Touché, leaving now.
She disconnected. I had time to kill, so I went for an early lunch at Taco Maria in Costa Mesa. While I ate arrachera tacos, I thought about the best approach to Orton. I knew that it might be the one and only time to get an audience with him. Would Emily and I maintain the cover of the story we had told Rexford PR we were doing, or would we confront him? Based on what I had heard from Detective Ruiz, I was pretty sure that Orton would not bend if confronted. It was likely that a direct approach would only get us shown to the door. Still, it might be useful to see how he would react and possibly defend himself against the accusations leveled against him while he was a professor at UCI. Or what he would say if we asked if the DNA from 4 dead women at the center of our story had ended up in the lab at Orange Nano.
The tacos were excellent, and I finished with 90 minutes to go before the appointment with Horton. As I was walking through the parking lot, my phone buzzed. It was Rachel. "Did you just get up?" I said. "No, I'm at work, thank you," she said. "Well, I thought you'd call sooner. Did you see my note?" "Yes, I saw it. I just wanted to get to work and start my day. Are you down in Orange County?"
"Yeah, I'm here. I talked to the detective who handled the Orton case."
"What did he say?"
"Not much, but I think he wanted to talk. He asked for my card, and that usually doesn't happen, so we'll see."
"Now what?"
"I meet Orton at 2. His corporate sponsor set it up."
"I wish I was there. I could give you a good read on him."
"Well, the other reporter is coming down. 3 would be a crowd, and I'm not sure how I would explain who..."
"I was just saying, Jack. I know it's not my story or case."
"Oh, well, you could always give me a second-hand read tonight."
"Mistral?"
"Or I could come over the hill to you."
"No, I like Mistral. I'll be there, after work."
"Good, I'll see you then." I got in my car and just sat there for a long moment thinking. Though the feelings and senses of the night before had been fogged by alcohol, they were nonetheless wonderful to me. I was with Rachel again, and there was no better place in the world to be. But it was always hope and hurt. Hope and hurt. With her, there had never been one without the other. And I had to prepare myself for the same cycle again. I was riding on the high now, but history and the laws of physics were clear. What goes up always comes down. I put the address of the lab into my GPS app and drove by Orange Nano a few times before pulling over on MacArthur Boulevard and using the cell to look up and call the offices of Hervé Gaspar, the lawyer who had represented Jane Doe. I identified myself as a reporter who needed to talk to the attorney for a story that would be posted by the end of the day. Most lawyers wanted their names in the media. It was free advertising. As expected, I was transferred to his cell phone and could tell I had caught him in a restaurant, eating.
"This is Hervé Gaspar. What can I do for you?"
"My name's Jack McAvoy. I'm a reporter for Fair Warning up in L.A.
"What the hell is a Fair Warning?"
"Good question. It's a consumer protection news site. We watch out for the little guy."
"Never heard of it."
"That's okay. There are many who have, especially the charlatans we expose on a regular basis."
"What's it got to do with me?"
I decided to jump over all the buildup.
"Mr. Gaspar, sounds like you're eating, so I'll get to the point. Taco Maria, ever been here?"
"Yeah, about 20 minutes ago."
"Really?"
"Really. And now I have a 2 o'clock interview with William Orton. If you were me, what would you ask him?" There was a long silence before Gaspar responded.
"I would ask him how many lives he's ruined."
"You know about Orton?"
"I know about the case involving your client."
"How?"
"Sources. What can you tell me about it?"
"Nothing. It was settled and everybody signed NDAs.
Non-disclosure agreements. The bane of a reporter's life."
"I thought no lawsuit was filed," I said.
"There wasn't, because we reached a settlement."
"And you can't share the details of it?"
"No, I can't."
"Is there any place where this settlement would be recorded?"
"No."
"Can you tell me your client's name?"
"Not without her permission, but she can't talk to you either."
"I know that, but can you ask her?"
"I can, but I know the answer will be no."
"You'll be at the